We're taking you behind the scenes with entrepreneurs that run product-based businesses. There is so much information out there tailored towards service providers, so we have carved out a space just for you. The creative entrepreneurs making and selling physical goods. We're firm believers that everyone has a story to share, and there is so much we can learn from each other's business journey. Whether you are just starting out or a seasoned business owner, this podcast will shed light on new strategies, inspiration, and action steps to help you grow your product-based business. Hey friends, I'm Katie Hunt, and welcome to Proof to Product. Today on the show, I have Michelle Laredo with me. She is a business consultant and financial strategist for wedding and event professionals. As the founder of Sage Wedding Pros, she shares her corporate and entrepreneurial experience and expertise to strengthen wedding businesses worldwide. Michelle worked as an accountant for Deloitte, a sales and marketing manager for DDLA, a merchandiser for Coach, and she owned a wedding stationery business. Through Sage Wedding Pros, Michelle produces the Next Level Summit Be Sage Conference, which I have had the privilege of attending twice, once as a speaker. It's a really amazing program, and her next one is in Austin in February of 2020. Michelle is a frequent speaker at professional conferences, and she loves talking about business planning, finances, and scalability of business. Some of that is what we talk about today. On today's episode, Michelle and I talk about business planning, the economics of selling products, and how financial decisions in your business affect your operational plans as well. Enjoy. Michelle Laredo, welcome to Proof to Product. How are you?
I'm doing so well. Thank you for having me, Katie.
I'm really excited to talk to you today because, well, I don't want to give away the secret of what we're talking about, but talking about money and geeking out on like sales data and all that stuff is super exciting to me. So I'm excited to have you here. But let's start off talking about your journey in business first off. So we give people your background. You and I have a very similar story in that we worked in corporate, had a creative business, and then we moved into more of a consulting role. So take us back to your early days. Where did you start your career?
I started at Deloitte. My degree is in accounting. So way back when, 20 plus years ago, I also worked in sales and marketing for a couple other companies, including Coach, did visual merchandising for them. So then in 2004, I started a stationery business. I mean, that's how I really got into the product world. Very similar to you, where you come from corporate, also went into stationery.
Yeah.
And then in 2009, I started writing a business blog for the wedding and events industry. Sage Wedding Pros was initially a blog that turned into a consulting business that it is today.
That's so cool. Yeah. I don't think I realized it was 10 years.
10 happy years.
Happy 10 years
Thank
to you.
Thank you.
Yeah. So how did you know it was time to shift out of that creative space of making the stationery and wedding products into more of a consulting role? What was kind of the tipping point there?
It's so interesting because I started the blog without thinking that it would evolve into this huge other thing. I was really trying to connect with more people nationwide for my stationery business. It was 2009. The economy wasn't doing so great. So in terms of product and stationery, I had the same amount of orders, but people were cutting back on the volume. So yeah. I worked directly with wedding people. I didn't do any wholesale. And so my thought was, well, I just need more clients. I need more business. And so I have to get out of my Seattle market. And so I'm going to start writing a blog. I didn't want to write about the creative aspects. I wanted to write a bit about the business aspects. And I'd had all people always asking me, how do I track my ROI? How do I read a profit and loss report? So I said, well, I'm going to put some of these things that I know from my corporate experience into a business blog. And so started writing about some of these things. One of the first things we started talking about was business planning. We had a post way back when was 13 steps to write a business plan. That evolved into our first workshop that started teaching, which was the Simple Plan. And since then, you know, we have added to that, but that's where it really kind of first started coming into teaching people how to do some of these things for their business. I'd say about 2 or 3 years into the blog and the workshops is when I started doing more consulting for people.
Isn't it interesting? So again, I don't mean to keep comparing our stories, but I felt the same way. You know, I came from a business background, business development and marketing background, and I looked around and I was so in awe of all these creative people I was working with. They were colleagues. You know, I was looking at my colleagues saying, gosh, you're so talented. Like, I need some of that, like, creative juju, right? Uh-huh. Like, I need help on the creative side. And yet they needed help on the business side. And it's – there's so – I guess what I'm trying to say is there's so much in our backstory. Everyone has the backstory, mm-hmm. right? That we can then weave into these businesses we're creating and we can help one another. And I think it's wonderful that you started writing that blog and started sharing your story.
Yeah.
And in the process, found your true calling for what you love to do now,
too. And that's the thing. And you probably found this too, a few years into, you know, teaching workshops. And I started to realize I am way better at the business side of my business than the artistic side. And that has even blossomed, you know, 10 times in the last 10 years, because what people do creatively now in creative field and in my industry specifically is just amazing. I would never be able to compete with that from our artistic level.
I'm over here nodding my head yes ferociously, because I agree. I'm just in awe of what they do, and I know that that's not where my strength lies. But it was fun, and I really enjoyed it, and I have a deep passion for it, as you do for your clients as well.
Yeah.
So now you work with entrepreneurs that are mainly in that wedding and event space, and tell us about – you mentioned some of the products and workshops and things that you have already, but tell us how you help them.
Yeah. So I do business plan coaching, where I teach people one-on-one how to create a business plan. Business plan is kind of like this old fuddy-duddy word, but it's really a strategy guide for your business. What is it that you want to do with your business, and how are you going to get there? And then I do a lot of financial strategy consulting as well, where I develop a financial plan for that business owner for the upcoming year, 2 years, however far out they want to go. Typically, that person comes to me with a challenge they're facing or a goal. I want to add, you know, a couple full-time employees. What does that look like to my business? Can I do it? How does it increase my sales volume or not? Working with all of these attributes. So those are the two things that I primarily do one-on-one.
I agree with you. The business plan, it sounds like this overly daunting task, but really it's just honing in on your focus for the business. And do you work with people to help them find their focus if they're trying to do too many things, or, you know?
Yes, absolutely. The wonderful thing about the traditional business plan is that it really forces you to look at all aspects of your business, not just the ones that come comfortably. So I think creative business owners, a lot of times they'll focus on marketing because that's the closest, you know, creative, at least visually a lot of times, to what they do in their craft, but they don't know anything about the operational side or the financial side. And that those pieces can be overwhelming. And I think that that's the benefit of working with me, is talking through some of those pieces that can be overwhelming or can be entirely confusing operationally, how to bring on staff, or if you have product, you know, working with vendors, order fulfillment, you know, delivery, distribution, all of those things. The business plan puts all of those pieces together, because you can't really make one decision without it triggering something else. You can't make a marketing decision without thinking of the financial aspects. Every financial decision links to an operational or marketing decision. So the business plan is really the way to get all of these question marks in your business, or really thinking about where you want your business to go in the future, putting it all down on paper. And it doesn't have to be an old fuddy-duddy process. It can be bullet points and charts and things like that. But the goal is to basically get all of that stuff out so that you have a direction for your company.
Absolutely. I like, too, how you mentioned that everything is correlated, because it absolutely is. The example you gave, too, of if they want to hire somebody down the road, like how do they make sure that they're – you know, that's something I see quite a bit in my world of coaching, where it's like people are underwater. They're feeling overwhelmed, and they know they need to bring in some people in strategic roles, but they're not quite sure how to do that. And they're not sure how to do it in a way that feels sustainable for the business. It doesn't put them in a financial like crunch, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know, I think too, people also sometimes look at things in silo. And I wonder if you see this, where it's like, oh, well, if I hire somebody, then I just need to sell this much more. Or I need to do this. Like, do you find them rationalizing certain decisions?
Yes, absolutely. Oh my gosh. That's such a great example, because I see somebody say, okay, I'm going to hire a part-time person. They're going to cost me $20,000 a year. If I sell XYZ and that equals $20,000 in sales, we're good. But the reality is that's not scaling a business, because you're just breaking even on that investment. If you truly want to scale a business, you want to look at how that $20,000 investment is going to grow your business exponentially. So if you're investing $20,000 in that person, I would want to see $40,000 in sales growth. That number is arbitrary. Right. You come up with that, what that is, but you want to see an exponential income growth. It may not happen in the first year, right? So putting those numbers in place is how long does it take for me to get from that $20,000 investment to the first milestone, which is paying for itself, but then the second, the ultimate milestone, which is scaling the business where that $20,000 investment mm-hmm. has led to $40,000 or $50,000 in additional income. And yeah. all investments or most investments should be looked at in that lens, really.
Absolutely. I agree with you, whether that's hiring mm-hmm. a person, exhibiting mm-hmm. at a trade show, expanding your product line, you know, getting a space outside of your home, if that's where you're at. Like, these are all just examples, but I feel like every decision needs to come back to how does this fit with the overall goals, the overall focus? What kind of questions do you specifically have your clients, like, what do you ask your clients specifically to help them hone in on whether that decision they're weighing is worth moving forward on or not? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it's about getting them to become investigators with their business. I have an audit background, right? So every decision gets scrutinized. I'm a scrutinizer. And it's really just trying to train them into practicing that art of scrutiny and thinking of like, mm-hmm. what are all the chain links that come from this one decision, right? So if you decide to invest in a print ad, for example, what are the links that happen, other decisions that come from that? Well, first you have to have the money to invest in that print ad. Then you have to go back to your marketing right. strategy and think about, you know, what will your branding communicate through this? Who's your target market? What are your sales goals as a result of this print ad? Mm-hmm. And so every single little decision then triggers, you know, 10 other decisions. But it's really getting yeah. them to think about all of these other little triggers so that they're making these decisions intentionally and not just going about blindly. That takes practice, like all things in life, right?
Oh my gosh.
You know?
Absolutely.
It's taken me 20 years to Absolutely. Figure all that stuff out, right? And people feel really overwhelmed on day one of their business trying to figure out. It's like you're not going to figure it all out now. But if you start practicing some of these ideas, you're going to be in a much better place a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now.
Yeah. 100%. I know that you and I are both numbers geeks yeah. when it comes to business, you know, and I really believe that decisions need to be driven by the analytics and the, you know, audit that you were just talking about, but also by the numbers. Does this make sense for us? So, you know, when you and I were emailing before this episode, you had used the phrase economics of yeah. selling products. And I'd love for you, can you define what that means for our audience?
Yeah. So this is something I encounter a lot when people are thinking of ways to expand their business. So in weddings and events, we're often service providers in our industry, and your listeners may be in a service-based business now, and they're thinking, how can I add product to my business to diversify what it is that I do, whether it's online tools or templates, downloads, things like that, or an actual physical product. Selling services Yep. is really different from products. So if you're trying to use the same mindset in terms of scaling the business, it's not going to work. So first of all, product, physical product, you have an inherent cost underlying, right? So with stationery, you know, we might sell something at $10, but it cost us $2.50 to produce, okay? So that's something right. you have to take into consideration, that if you are launching product, there's an inherent cost. Floral is another big one. If you have a digital product, it's less, right? You have a development cost. You don't have any hard per piece costs to go out, but you have an initial investment. It may be a huge investment for a digital product. If you're producing videos and things like that, it could cost you several thousand dollars. So you have to think of the turnaround right. on that investment. So what I find Excellent. To be an interesting challenge is when somebody's trying to think of how do I sell more of my widgets, right? So if I'm selling $10 product, an easy solution, I know you talk about this a lot on your show, is moving to wholesale, because how do you get that volume? If you're selling mm-hmm. a card, you can't be selling card by card by card. You need to be looking at how to sell bundles, right? Like packages, the quote unquote bundle, right. but really sets of cards, station, working with retailers to get product in stores is ultimately an incredible yeah. strategy. What a lot of people don't always have in mind or think about is that once you lower your price from a retail price to a wholesale price, you're minimizing your margin. So it means you have to do even more volume, right? It's not just yeah, the easy absolutely. Solution. So you really have to run those numbers to see, okay, right now I can sell 500 cards at $10 and I'm getting, you know, 75% of the pie. I'm getting a huge piece of the pie because I'm direct to consumer. Or right. I move to a wholesale model and now I have to sell, you know, 15,000 of these cards to get the same amount of profit, right? Because your profit's been cut. So you have right. to measure those two things out to see if they make sense for you, for your business. Moving. Now, this is the other interesting thing. When we were talking about the links, like all the things that trigger. So when you're selling direct to consumer, yes. you have to sell those, you know, 5,000 pieces versus the 15,000. This is where we come down to, okay, operationally, what does that look like? I'm now moving from 5 to 15,000. Do I have an operational structure that can support that? Because I know me, myself, working all yep. alone in my little office, I can satisfy 5,000 because I've done it. How in the world do I satisfy 15,000? Yep. Okay, I have to hire help now, or I have to get other people that are going to help me produce the product, whether it's, you know, colleagues or partners or white label or whatever have you. All of a sudden, I need to deliver all of this. My operational structure has changed entirely. With that operational structure, financial structure yes. changes. When you add these financial pieces, additional vendors, additional staff, all of a sudden your margin's going down even more for introducing the wholesale. So now you don't have to sell 15,000, you have to sell 30,000. And the chain goes on, right? Because the more you add, the more complex your business goes through operationally, okay?
Yeah. So, and you're right too that this is even more tricky for the lower price yes. products compared.
I see you, friend, juggling all the things in your business and wondering where you can get some relief. Well, first of all, you are not alone. And secondly, this is why I want to introduce you to Gusto. Gusto makes payroll, employee benefits, and HR support super easy for small business owners who don't have a lot of time on their hands. Whether you have a team of full-time employees or independent contractors, Gusto makes the payroll process fast and simple. They also have really great resources and tools available for entrepreneurs to help you plan ahead. So new hire checklists, salary comparison tools, and even tax calculators. You're likely not an expert in HR and payroll. I know I'm not. And so with Gusto, you don't have to be. Proof to Product listeners get 3 free months of Gusto when you run your first payroll. So try out a demo and see for yourself at gusto.com/proof. Again, that's 3 free months when you sign up through gusto.com/proof.
And I will say that is why we have seen a shift specific to the stationery. I mean, this is what you're talking about is true for any type of product that anyone yes. is selling. However, looking specifically at the stationery industry, majority of the people that we work with, majority that I work with through Proof to Product and that come through Paper Camp, many of them are branching out into more gift items because mm-hmm. they do have that higher profit margin. They do have, you know, just you can make the numbers yes. work a little bit more. And I will say, too, the way they've weaved them into their companies, it's been very seamless. You know, they have now a suite of products that make sense together. Mm-hmm. So the products they bring in do complement the greeting cards or other paper products that they're selling. Yeah. But I would say the majority of the stationery businesses in our community are doing more gift
yeah.
too.
Yeah. I mean, you can see that across any product line, even with digital product, right? Where there isn't a physical yes. cost. If you're selling, you know, downloads at $10, $15, you're just going to have to sell so much more than bundling, you know, an entire set. Maybe it's like a new year bundle where you put all of your downloads together and you're able to get more bang for your buck. There isn't a quote unquote cost of goods sold component with digital, but it's really the marketing effort that you have to do there. You yeah. know, if you have to sell 10,000 digital products to see a profit, you have to hustle your butt in newsletters, in, you know, Facebook advertising, all of that versus having to sell, you know, 150 units, right? It's different. Yeah. So
it also goes, it was something you just said, just sparked something in me. It also goes back to time versus yes. money, right? So like, in the physical product world, we do have hard costs. Mm-hmm. We do have like hard time mm-hmm. commitments to creating those products and packaging those products, the labor side of it. Thank you. That's the word I was looking for. And then on the digital side, yes, there's not like you still have the time you need to create the product, the thought process behind it, the, you know, writing out the script for a video or creating the PDF or whatever. Like, there is that time factor. So there are costs that go into it. It's just, it's interesting. I don't know what my point was.
I look at the digital one more of like a front up, almost like an asset investment.
Right, totally.
So you have the labor that's all up front, and maybe you have photography and video that you're investing. And let's say that all of those things together cost $5,000 up front. Whereas like a physical product, you know, you if you're doing letterpress, maybe you have plates and things like that. But it's really like the cost per piece that you identify production more costs, with a physical product.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Okay. What mistakes do you see people making, particularly in the physical product world, when they're thinking about bringing a product to market? So we've already talked about the fact that when you sell wholesale versus retail, and there's, of course, a lot of other ways to sell your products as well, but looking at just those two sales channels, you do have different pricing and marketing strategies and sales strategies like we talked about. The audiences you're speaking to are entirely different.
Yes.
So I guess before you even get to that phase of figuring out which sales channel you should be targeting, like what mistakes or missteps are people making just in that ideation, like figuring out their pricing, figuring out their product stage?
So oftentimes things are priced too low. They haven't taken into consideration all the cost input. And it's not just the cost of material. It is that cost of labor that you said. So I'll use myself as an example. When I first started stationery, I felt like I had really great margins because I was like tripling or quadrupling my materials. But the reality was I didn't have my labor factor in mind.
Yeah.
And so I got to a point where it was very difficult to replace myself as the worker in my business because I didn't have that factored into my pricing strategy.
Yeah.
And so when I'm working with people, one of the first things we do, even if you're like the first year in business, is, okay, let's look at right now what your profit per piece is based on your model right now. Now let's play a what if scenario. If we were to replace you as the workhorse in creating this product, you're still the president of your business, but you're replacing yourself as the workhorse. What do you have to pay somebody? Maybe not at your skill set, but to basically fold on, you know, fold ribbon and tie ribbon and glue cards together. What does that look like?
Yeah.
What does that do to your cost factor? So that's something that I see coming out of the gates, is that people haven't thought about that labor factor going into any sort of product.
I see that too. I also see people getting tripped up on the fact that, like, you know, when you're starting it, you're very, whatever you're starting a business, it's very exciting. There's a lot you don't know. So you're learning as you go. And you're really just, again, you're in that silo handling the things that are in front of you that need to be done. You're not really thinking big picture. You're not really thinking, what does this look like in 5-10 years? What do I want it to look like in 5 or 10 years? And I was guilty of that too, because you're just like, again, trying to get the momentum with what you've got going.
Yeah. Let's be honest, most of us start this stuff because it's a hobby. I mean, mine was, I didn't study design or stationery. I had no idea. So it was like, I love paper. I want to play with paper. Let me just sell some cards here on the side. And 2 years in, we're like, oh my gosh, my side gig is no longer my side gig. What am I doing? And so that's the thing, is that we started as a passion project, and it is. At some point you need to make the decision, am I going to continue this as a passion project, or am I going to get serious about this? At that point you have to decide, what am I doing with pricing? What am I doing with my margins? That's where you really have to kind of sit down and understand what those things mean. Come, you know, look at those numbers, you know, how many of these items do I need to sell to be profitable, to earn a living off of?
Right. Yeah. So we're running our PaperCamp e-course right now. And this week is all about product development. And one of those pieces is pricing as well. And I always tell people, I want you to work your numbers from two different directions.
Yes.
I want you to work your numbers from the bottom up, meaning look at all your production costs, your materials, your labor, even overhead, factor some of that into that and see where, you know, what your hard cost is. What's your production cost for one piece? And then, you know, I don't really believe in using different equations that are out on the internet, like double that hard cost or triple that hard cost.
I totally agree with that. Yeah.
Because it just, it can push you into a zone that like is just unrealistic. But then I tell people to work their numbers from top down too. And what I mean by that is looking at what the market can bear. What are other products in your world, competitors to you? What are they priced at? What bells and whistles do they have? Like try to compare apples to apples as best you can. But that top number is going to tell you kind of the maximum of what the market will bear. And you want your pricing to be somewhere in between that bottom up number and that top down number, because if you price it too low, you will not make any money on your products. If you price it too high, you'll price yourself out of the market and nobody's going to buy. Yes. So you really do need to know your personal numbers, but then you have to be aware of what the market is doing and where you fit into that as well.
Yeah. I always say, I teach that very similarly. You look at your cost, you kind of come up with that first guesstimate of what you think it should be. And then you have to look at it. Like, what does it look like? Because you may come up like, okay, I can do $5 and it looks really good. But then like really look at it, know your competition, know what you're comparing it to. Does it look like that? Or does it look like $10? Price it to what you think the market will bear at the end of the day. Marketing is actually, pricing is actually a marketing decision. It's not a financial decision. It's a marketing decision that you test financially. So you really need to make that that decision based on understanding competition, your market, who you're selling to, your target market, your ideal, quote unquote, ideal client, the service that you're providing, your experience, your expertise. Does it fill a specific niche or void that nobody else has? Because that premium, that rarity needs to demand a stronger price if you're one of the few people, or only people that do this. You know, niche equals rarity equals premium value equals a higher price. You have to have those things in mind. And so you price it with all of those marketing factors in mind, as opposed to numbers factors. And then you need to see, test it financially. Does it make sense for what your costs are, your cost of goods sold, your cost of labor, and then your overhead expenses as well. Don't forget to throw in, like, what is it that you want to earn from that, right?
Right. Yeah. You need your profit margin. You need what are you going to pay yourself? What are you going to reinvest in the business? Another thing I tell our more seasoned companies, because we've talked a little bit more about like what to do in the early days, but one of the things I tell, and I'd love your opinion on this too, I tell our people, you need to be looking at your production costs at least once a year or when you have big shifts in things, because, you know, sometimes your materials costs will go up. Sometimes you get more efficient in how you're doing things and your labor costs might go down, for example. So you need to be reassessing these things and also checking in on what the market's doing, because if the market's going up, then you can move your pricing up.
And I feel like people should always be trying to like increase that profit margin percentage. So knowing what those numbers are doing is so critical from season to season, month to month, quarter to quarter, year to year. You know, if the first time you look at those percentages, it's not going to tell you anything because you have no basis of comparison. But let's say in year one, you've got a 60% profit margin. So you're profiting 60 cents on every dollar. Well, your goal should be in year two to try to get that up to 65 to 70% and so on and so forth. You're always trying to squeeze it. You're going to get to a point where you can't go beyond, right? Like, I don't know, 90%, that's wild. I don't know if I see that with most products. It depends on the product naturally, but you need to know those numbers because you should be trying to get more profit out of your product every single year.
Absolutely. One of the questions we get asked at Paper Camp every single time, like I know it's coming like clockwork, is what should a standard profit margin percent be? And I should have a canned answer for this already because we get asked it all the time. But friends listening, like your circumstances are so different than the person sitting next to you. Like, so ultimately you need to be competing with yourself, which I love how you frame that, Michelle, of like competing with yourself and trying to get your profit margin as high as you can. But it's really, there are not necessarily like industry, and correct me if you feel differently, but there's not industry profit margins because how one person creates their products is different than another. The materials they use is different than another. The overhead is different. Like it's comparing apples to oranges.
Absolutely.
But if you are continuing to compare your own profit margin year over year, quarter over quarter, like you were talking about, you can see the growth. You can see how you're streamlining your costs and maybe, you know, increasing your prices if necessary. Yeah.
I mean, if you're a runner or swimmer, you're going to know the idea of like trying to beat your personal best. It's the same concept. People always ask me, like, not just in the stationary world, but in floral, that's a big one. Like, what should my benchmarks be? And I said, yeah, it doesn't matter. I have seen product-based businesses that can thrive at only 30 or 40% profit margin. And I've seen businesses struggle at 70% profit margin, right? Yeah. There's so many moving parts. Overhead is, you know, cost is a big one. Overhead's another one. Mm-hmm. How much you want to earn, right? Somebody may not need to earn as much as somebody else. Good and point. That's a huge factor in it as well. And it comes down to sales volume, right? Like, you may be somebody that is doing fine at 50%, but you have to hustle a lot more than someone who is profiting 70%, right? Right. So that person at 70% doesn't need to do as high of a volume as the person who has a margin of 50%. But they could be selling entirely different things, right? Mm-hmm. So that volume for the 50% has to be higher. So there's no percentage. You need to know your margins. You need to create benchmarks. You need to try to best your benchmarks. If you're not happy with what you're earning, that's the red flag that you need to be aware of, is if you're mm-hmm. not earning enough, that's where you need to say, I need to boost my profit margin by 2 to 5% in the next year, at least.
Yeah. I have also seen people diversifying their income because, how do I explain this? Like, they'll try to sell retail, they'll try to sell wholesale, they might add in licensing, they might, like, they'll add in different sales channels and different revenue streams to kind of counterbalance, like, seasons in the business and things. Do you think that that leads to stronger business, or do you think it creates more of a scattered approach and less focus?
I think it's hard to be good at all things. My recommendation always with that is, create your first channel that is does really well, and only after that is profiting and you're thriving with it, can you expand into the second channel. And then once that second channel is amazing, then the third channel. Don't jump around, because here's the problem. If you're trying to do three channels at once, you're only giving 33% of your time and energy to every single channel. It is way too hard to be successful in business when you're only giving 33% to something. You need to give 100% to everything that you're doing as a business owner. So give 100% to that first channel. So not just in terms of time, but in terms of, like, marketing. People get really confused when you're selling three things that are very different. Wait, are you selling wholesale? Are you selling retail? What's this licensing thing? I'm not sure I understand that, right? And so the message gets really blurred when you're trying to do too many things, be, you know, all things to all people.
I agree with you 100%. The other thing is, too, when you focus on one and get the systems and the processes and, like, you get that engine running strong, you don't need to give it as much time and effort. You can, like, it's easier for you to kind of peel off and work on the second channel if that's what you choose.
Yes. And you also come from a place of strength when you introduce that second channel, because people see, oh, you're so successful with the first channel. Amazing. Let's see how number two does, as opposed to like people not really sure if you're killing it or not on channel number one.
Totally. Yeah. Well, what's next for you and Be Sage? What do you have coming up that you want to share with us?
Yeah, so we have Be Sage Conference. We've had Katie speak to all the listeners. Katie was, like, one of the favorites in our fourth year.
Oh, you're sweet.
So Be Sage Conference is a wedding conference for a wedding and event professionals, actually. It's a business conference. And we work with business owners who have been in business typically at least 5 years, because we're working with next level topics. So this year we're talking about things like how to create an exit strategy if you don't plan on working in your business till you're 100 years old, how to hire managers. So what I start to see people go through a few years into business is they've hired their low level team, and now they become the manager, and they want to get to the point where they are much more like the visionary and the creative director within their business. But it's hard to do that when you're overseeing a team of 5 to 10 people all the time. So it's really introducing that middle tier, which I don't think exists in a lot of creative businesses, where you have a manager who's really overseeing. So we're going to have Kim Hanks from Wim Hospitality talk about that. And then we're have Jason Fitzgerald coming to talk about very similar idea, but with services, where we're talking about moving from like a large volume of events to a small volume of events, really working with that pricing so that you're not having to be on a treadmill of events for the rest of your life.
That's really cool. I will say Michelle puts on amazing events, and not just with like the experience is awesome, but the content is fantastic and the people that are there are really amazing. I have attended two of her conferences. I spoke at one of them, but Michelle's doing a really great job with high level content. And you're right, for that more seasoned, experienced entrepreneur. So,
yeah, well, thank you. I love the curriculum part of it. I always kind of, I warn my speakers, I'm going to micromanage because I need to make sure that that our people are learning how to do things. So,
well, and you care so deeply about your audience and your students that you want to make sure they're getting the help that they need right then and there, which I love about it. So, Well, where can people find you online if they want to find out more about the conference or follow you on social media?
Yeah. So the conference is at besage conference.com, and that's happening in Austin, Texas. So tacos and queso, February 3rd through the 6th. And then you can find the main part of our business at Sage, S-A-G-E, wedding, W-E-D-D-I-N-G, pros.com.
Awesome. We will include that in the show notes for anyone that's interested in checking out your conference or learning more about you and also reading all of the amazing business blog posts that you have there. I'm excited to go dive back in as well. So, thank you so much for coming, Michelle. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Katie. It's been really fun talking with you.
You as well.
Thanks so much for spending time with us today. Head on over to proofyourproduct.com to join the conversation, access our show notes, and discover free resources to help you build your product-based business. We'll be back next week with a new episode. Thanks again.